I know that it's not possible for us to construct as careful a kind of set of expectations for our approach to this material as we would perhaps like, but I thought that one of the nice ways to end a week and to prepare for Sunday would be to do it in the way in which two different ways. The way in which a 17th century divine, George Herbert, did it, and the other, the way in which a very secular but very sensitive contemporary poet, George Herbert, also did it. Wallace Stevens also. I have to admit, I came back from a 9-mile hike and I gave in to an impulse to have a can of beer. And I'm not accustomed to that, but it tasted so good. Wallace Stevens will represent a kind of a very content to a meditative situation. And I do that largely on the basis of a kind of a paradox I see at Holden as I look at the entire setup of the camp as a newcomer and also respond to your library, which strikes me as one of the finest little collections I've seen of almost polar opposites. You know, a lot of books on meditation, contemplation, and then an awful lot of books on social action, justice, and the concerns of the Christian community. For that reason, I thought it might be good to take contrast and compare two different types of poets like George Herbert and Wallace Stevens, and to do so in the roughly 50 minutes that we have. Anyone else want a copy of the poem or poems, which we'll move through rather rapidly?
Thank you.
Ask a kind of a straightforward question. My assumption is that most of you, though you may know the names of George Herbert and Wallace Stevens, some of you may not know the names of Wallace Stevens and George Herbert. Is there anyone here who does or is familiar with the poetry of George Herbert or Wallace Stevens? Okay. Probably teach a course in Wallace Stevens.
It was major
a long time ago. All right. Okay, we all have copies of the text here. Let me tell you just quickly about the two men, just to sketch in what the background is. My intention of working here with these two or three poems is to both prepare ourselves for the coming weekend and the way in which a 17th century poet like George Herbert or John Donne or many of the meditative poets of the 17th century would have. They, as a matter of fact, and it was a matter that we, so far as we know, it probably came out of the experience of the reaction to the Counter-Reformation. As you may or may not be familiar with the pattern, men in the 17th century learned how to meditate primarily because the Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit Society, and others were very concerned about the regaining, I think, through a very careful strategy, the depth of the Christian experience that they felt might have been lost and threatened, certainly, by the Reformation. And so what they did, is they introduced a rigid kind of discipline into the Christian life that was tied, we know, liturgically. For example, I, several years ago, read some in Eastern Orthodoxy, which has a much longer, much more ancient liturgical tradition and worshiping tradition than we have in the West. They will argue that, for example, something like Matins and Vespers that we tend as Protestants to view rather casually, to be part of the what they call the ordo, that is the very structure of the universe for an Eastern Orthodox, with the sun rising in the morning and the sun setting, in our terms, in the evening, is so stable and ordered and fixed and divinely ordained the pattern of human life that you are expected and required as an obedient Christian in your discipline to rise in the morning. They had an ancient service called what we call our matin service, which is related to the Latin for the rising of the sun. They call it the orthrus, which is itself a name for the sun. And immediately they would rise in the morning, the monks, and they would have their worship for the rising sun, which was equated with the person of Christ. And so for them, this was no accident, no arbitrary symbolic way of talking about the relationship between Christ and the created world. That is the way it was. And they were met there in light. That's why in the Creed we have that confession, very God of very God, light of light, as a statement of the whole wrapping up of this together in the ancient notion of the relationship of a human being in the pattern and discipline of his daily life. Well, men like Herbert come out of this experience. He was deeply influenced, as most of you may know, by a man named John Donne. And what he did, he's just a marvelous kind of human being. He was born, of course, in a very distinguished, noble family, the Herberts, and his brother went on to become a very distinguished philosopher, Lord Herbert of Cherbury. Another brother became a distinguished military man, and George Herbert was left to become probably the only opening that was left to him because he could not go into the into the state. He was left with the possibility of church orders. And so having taught for a long time at Cambridge, and particularly in the field of rhetoric, he left and became a parish pastor in a little place outside of London. And, he's a very fascinating kind of man, I guess for so many reasons. I find it that he took time, for example, to write the first book that we have available in the West, what we would call a pastoral theology. It was a little book on, hey, if you're a pastor in a parish, one of the things you better be sure is that at least your church is clean on Sunday. And he has little instructions about being sure there's no spider webs behind the altar, and if you're going to serve from the altar, clean it off. And then because he was a bachelor, he went through the problem. Now, what do you do when you're a really good pastor in the community and you want to be in the counseling and pastoral relationship with your people? And he recognized that maybe it would be good for me to get married. So he reflected on this, and he said, and I always think of Albert Camus, who in our age said, always pick a woman with your gonads. And George Herbert said, always pick a woman with your ear. Listen to her voice, and in that voice you will find everything that she is. You know, it sounds so totally different from a world dominated by the eye. Well, Herbert was a man who, unlike most writing poets who write to be read, wrote many, many poems. His particular genius resting upon the fact that he never reduplicated any metrical style more than once. He was such a genius and so careful. As a musician himself, incidentally, he traveled once a week into London to play with his friends. It was one of the luxuries he permitted himself. But we do have anecdotes about the fact that on occasion he had to stop to help people who were stuck and got himself all muddied in his rather gentlemanly attire as he was going into London to play his particular lute with the group that he performed with. But in any case, what he did is on his own, primarily as a meditative exercise and as an exercise of what he understood to be his gifts and vocation as a Christian, he wrote a series of poems and put them in unpublished manuscript form. They were titled The Steps, it was really called The Temple. So that the poems are all arranged in the form of a 17th century church. And as you read through the book, Now, even if we took a college course in poetry and we maybe had to read some 17th century poetry, which is very seldom read anymore, you'll notice that even the anthology I take it from had to make footnotes to a poem from George Herbert, which is so obviously to a Christian about the sacrament, but which is so often misconstrued as being a love poem by many young students who read it, that they had to add footnotes in the text to say, when this poem is read, be sure to understand that it is about a service in the Christian church called the sacrament. Now, that may sound strange to you and to me, but if you've ever taught in a secular university and recognize how lacking most students are in any kind of historical knowledge of the Christian tradition, you'll understand why a poem like this may present a problem for any kind of reader. Well, in any case, he arranged this whole series of poems in the organization of a church. And so you have little poems that start out at the beginning of the book called Steps to the Temple. And they're rather marvelous. I suppose the thing I love about 17th century English metaphysical poets is that what they did was something that is probably most valuable for us and part of our experience in the 20th century. That's why T.S. Eliot liked them so much, is they were able to hold in suspension and creative relationship their doubts and their beliefs at the same time. That is, they were deeply committed men who could entertain all the doubts that you and I and the 17th century man could know. And they knew the doubts that you and I know. Their world was just simply flying apart. So that a Sir Thomas Browne, who was a, what we would call a lay physician, and wrote a meditation called The Meditations of a Lay Physician in the 17th century, wrote a marvelous study of that. He said, you know, he was really bothered as he was reading through the Old Testament to find out in the Book of Kings that the directions for the squaring of a circle were given. And so far as he knew anything about mathematics, he had great reservations about the nature of the mathematics that was present there. But he also knew that in terms of the Orthodox tradition that he had at the time, that he was supposed to accept that Bible and every word that was said. He says, what I have resolved, he says, I will not seek to solve this question with my head. I must solve it on my knees. And what he did was, he said, I will let these questions rest there. I know that they are difficult questions. And he pondered them carefully. And he had great reservations, for example, about the location of the soul. Where is it? There was an argument, of course, that it was located somewhere in the body as a physical thing. But all he saw as a physician, when he examined the corpses and even the coffins and the tombs that he saw, was that there was no possibility for any kind of vital organ in the human body to be a place where the soul was present as it was held at that time. He's a marvelous man, and any, I think, Holden hiker would love him, because what fascinated him were the what he called his o altitudos, the things that would turn him into a kind of meditative high. For example, he said, have you ever thought of how beautiful is the corrugated back of a toad? And he would reflect on the back of a toad, and he thought, my God, the God that created the back of a toad, or, he said, an insect's wing held up to the light, was enough to throw him into a great o altitudo, as he called it. So he would ponder the great mysteries of the Trinity and also wrote one of the first empirical studies that we have called Vulgar Errors. He was a typical 17th century empirical scientist. He noticed that, for example, there were all kinds of superstitions at that time. Do Jews smell? Yeah, just as we've heard it about other ethnic groups, and he probes that particular question. You'd laugh, or he pondered this question. How would, we hear it as a joke in our time, and I have always laughed. How would you pick Adam out of a crowd? You've heard it as a joke. Sure you have.
He has no
navel. He has no belly button. And he was Yeah, I don't think we really waste our time worrying about questions like that. But for a man, for an inquisitive, inquiring, strange, 17th century mind like Sir Thomas Browne, who could hold, say, for example, his belief in witchcraft with his absolute horror of the practice of the burning of witches. He didn't want to see anyone hurt, but he didn't want to deny, say, the 2 Samuel witch at Endor experience that he had read about in Scripture. These people were in deep anguish because they saw their scientific worldview beginning to shake, and their Scriptures was there as the authority and center of their tradition, and the tensions were explosive for all of them. I'm talking about men who we associate with the man that wrote these poems, George Herbert. So when he writes his poems and he entitles them The Steps to the Temple, the fascinating thing about it is how inclusive it is. Rather than being an exclusive Christian, Herbert, as a 17th century English humanist Christian, would like to be inclusive and say that the history of the Christian church, and he included the Renaissance and the medieval church and the ancient church, is that we include this all as a testimony. And not only that, all of the virtuous pagans. Now notice how he titles it, Steps to the Temple. You're not in the temple, but you're outside the temple. And outside the temple, you can include all the good, virtuous, ethical, aesthetic insights of the ancient world. So he had this very inclusive kind of thing. Then he goes inside, of course. He looks at the windows and the nave, and he takes us up to the altar. And all the poems are there, organized about the church itself, even to the baptismal font. And, peculiar enough, what he included is something we would consider, I remember doing some editing at one time, and you'd often get these little poems from very pious and well-meaning folk. The Lord's Prayer on the head of a pin, but we'd arrange it, maybe the Christmas story in the shape of a Christmas tree, or the Christmas story in the shape of a cradle, and it seemed so corny to do it, because it seemed so unrelated to the content. And then we realized that in the 17th century, in the piety of the time, they had a form of verse that we call hieroglyphic verse, or what we call today big modern movement in poetry, sometimes called action poetry, or even figure poetry. The French have worked with it, is to design the poetry so that the words and the visual arrangement of the language on the page suggest an integration not only with sound and idea, but with visual pattern also. Well, if you look into the 17th century and George Herbert's poetry, you would find it. So that the poem up in the upper left-hand page, side of the page, Easter Wings, would have been printed or written as he had it in the original manuscript on its side, so that the wings would look as if they were wings in flight, not as they are on this page and as they are usually printed, because they have to be read from left to right in Mr. McLuhan's linear pattern form, but they would have been printed as wings. And this would appear, as you might guess, right over the altar in the Easter Wings portion to give us some sense of the power of the resurrection in the Christian life. Around that altar, and there is a poem in the shape of the altar, there is also the poem on the right-hand side on the nature of Christian love, and particularly a meditation, so far as we can see, intimately related to the Christian celebration of the sacrament, and for Herbert, a part of the intimate nature of the Christian experience, in which he tries to tie two things together that many modern Christian poets would keep apart. A man like W.H. Auden, a man like T.S. Eliot, would say that probably piety and poetry do not mix. As Auden would put it, if you do any kind of writing, you're probably thinking of communicating it to an audience. So you're always doing it with an eye looking over your shoulder, someone which says, you know, look how neat he writes poetry, look how neat he communicates. And Mr. Eliot will say, the best of the meditators, he thinks, was a man whom we don't even refer to today, but a man who affected Mr. Eliot's poem, The Journey of the Magi. How many of you are familiar with that? Many of us may be. It's a man named Lancelot Andrews, a clergyman who was a contemporary, again, of Herbert and Sir Thomas Browne. And Eliot thought he was superb. And he says, the neat thing about Mr. Andrews is that when he meditated, even his sermons, they are totally on the object of his meditation. And so when you read a Lancelot Andrews sermon, I think the thing that strikes us most about it from the 20th century is how dull it is, because it seems so structured and it seems so objective. Whereas we expect, remember we even talked about the two hymns last night, it was really interesting to see the shift to always the involvement of the subject who must hold the faith, the relationship between God and the believer. Whereas for Eliot, he says, God, if there's anything he wants to get away from, it's from human feelings, subjective human feelings, which are there, varied, untrustworthy. We've got to get it on the eye on the object. In a way, Herbert is like that, but he is not so objective that he doesn't give us this tremendous sense of what I don't think either Auden or Eliot could do. Herbert was such a consecrated craftsman that when we read his poetry, and I am quoting from really from the most sympathetic or one of the most sympathetic essays I've ever heard on him, is by a Jewish man, Stanley Hyman, who reads and knows George Herbert well. Here is poetry which is so terribly unselfconscious, so craftsmanlike, but practiced by a man who is so unaware of himself except as a vocational Christian practicing his craft, that you cannot help but be caught up in not the man, but the object of his poetry. Hence, if you look at his poem, look at number 3 on the right-hand side. This is a meditation on the Christian who will participate in the sacrament. It is done, I suppose, in the same way that Eric Auerbach, the great author on the nature of the way in which reality is embodied in Western literature, and he says, probably one of the most revolutionary things that ever happened when you and I here on a Christmas Eve, our children in a Christmas Eve program recite Luke 2. Remember? It came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And Mr. Auerbach says, what's so startling about that? He says, here we have in Greek, plain Greek, a kind of plain Greek, monosyllables and disyllables that are telling us, you and me, about what? The birth of a God. In the entire ancient world, if you were talking about the birth of the gods, what style would automatically be necessary to communicate the reality of the birth of those gods to the believers? It would have to be an elevated, elaborate, and lofty style. But here in the New Testament, in Luke 2, the style creates a great rupture and the whole way in which the gods will be talked about. And of course here Mr. Herbert talks about going to communion in the way I wish, I suppose, every one of us in a way can't help but be caught up in. A simple exercise, monosyllables. But don't let it put you off, because as Elizabeth Drew says about many of the finest of poets, they are so simple on the surface. And then as you begin to watch it, you notice the translucence, even the transparency of the relationship between language and idea and feeling, brought to a kind of peak in a kind of poem like this. Anyone volunteer to read it aloud for us very quickly? Very simple.
Which one? Love?
First one, love.
Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me go slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here, love said, you shall be he. I the unkind, ungrateful? Ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply, Who made the eyes but I? Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat.
That is so simple in many ways that one, I suppose, vitiates the reading and the hearing of a poem by talking about it. And yet, I'm always caught in that kind of trap as a teacher. What do you do? I know my wife and many gentlemen and young ladies I speak to in college teaching say, God, I love this poetry until I took it in class. And what you did was you murdered it to dissect it, and then you dissected it before my eyes, and everything that moved me deeply fell between my fingers, and there it was lost. I've always felt this terrible guilt as an instructor for doing that, and at the same time, I've always felt that is basically a naive response to what happens. My understanding of the analysis of the poem is that what we do is we recognize that finally, where does the poem always have to be put together? Where must it be read as an experience? Primarily by you and me as individuals, probably in our own loneliness or with a friend reading to us. Hence, I like what Northrop Frye has always said, we do not teach literature in school. We can't. All I can do as a teacher is teach about it. And what I try to do is teach about it as carefully and as, sometimes as thoroughly as possible, and not to destroy it, but to recognize that there's always that one process that has to take place after you go from the classroom, and that is to sit down with the poem and go through the deepening emotional experience that comes on the basis of the analysis of the way it's been put together. Anyone who's played even a rudimentary game of tennis knows how much more fun it is to have analyzed all the strokes, at least somewhere along the line, before you get caught up in the game. So we're not going to do it to death by any means, but anything you notice about the poem? What's its basic structure? I might even give you a little bit more lead on that. One of our finest philosophers today, a European who's just being talked about over here in America, and he's been over here for several years, a good friend of the Paul Ricoeur that Mr. Bowman mentioned the other day, is a man named Hans-Georg Gadamer. And Hans-Georg Gadamer says, fundamentally, whenever you're going to talk about language, what must you posit as the basic relationship of all human beings when they are involved in the use of language? What is the situation? It comes out of, he says, even a strange kind of word that most of us know. You might guess, what's the form of this poem? What makes it move?
You mean it's a conversation?
Yeah. That's simple. It's a conversation. We would call it, I suppose, a dialogue. And I, for Mr. Gadamer, isn't this where it all begins, where all human life and communication begins? And Robert Frost will say, what is the first metaphor? It is, he says, a baby's smile. Because that baby's smile and the response across the human lines is language. Now, maybe not verbal language, but it's a tremendous connecting point between human beings that begins to be the source for much more building later on. Basically, a conversation between what two kinds of characters, would you say?
The persona, the author, persona, I, and allegorical figure of love, which I suppose I'd have to read a couple of times if it didn't have a footnote.
Yeah, it's true. It's probably true.
And of course, it's also, well, there's several ways you could attack it. One of is where is this all? It's in the recollection, because he is not present as the poetry is being produced, but is rather reporting, and he's not reporting from any one particular place, because he's omnipresent. He's where love is, and he's where he is. You don't have any focus of spatial focus there. So it's a conversation in a large room without a sense of staging or presentation.
Okay. All right. What you've done is you've moved to what we would call the scene.
Yeah.
The question I was asking, what about the agents, the actors?
It's a host and a guest.
All right. Now you've got the scene. In terms of the eternal setting, you've got the conversation, but now we suddenly recognize that the voices that we hear are voices in a character kind of relationship of host and guest, and that sets up the equation that you had set between the allegory of love and the intruder. All right, what about that relationship? Let's just push it a little bit further.
Reluctant guest.
A very reluctant guest. What about the nature of the host? Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin.
That's very active. Very active.
Okay, the very active host. Here is, Mark Twain handed me a little essay that from a friend of his who's doing a whole book on Herbert. And he says, Herbert, I haven't had a chance to read it, but it suggests that Herbert is very Lutheran in his theology. And of course, when we say that, we have a sense of the man who understands precisely the nature of the Christian gospel, the heart of it. And the heart of it is this Christ as host, who is seeking to relate in the conversation we have here. And the first impulse, Herbert recognizes, for most Christians, is that fundamental question that we see raised by every sensitive Christian poet. It's always a hard problem to cope with, namely, am I worthy or am I not worthy? And the first reply of the human being in this guest-host relationship is quite obviously, I am not worthy. But, and this is what's interesting, what's the first word of the poem? It's precisely where Herbert will always put the accent. It's on love and on the contrast between the host and the guest. Guilty of dust and sin. But quick, I'd love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in. And he's thinking of this temple. What did he do? He drew near to me. Remember Kierkegaard saying one time very beautifully, we are all equally near to God insofar as he is equally near to each of us. So he drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning, if I lacked anything. Well, my God, I just told you, I'm full of guilt, dirty, dust and sin. And what do I reply? Here the guest is enlarging on his unworthiness. What does he say? I guess I answered, worthy to be here in this space, this sacred space that love has set aside. What does love say? Now, just as we heard Mary Schramm in that meditation the other evening about John 21, you shall be.
You know, it's very tricky here, because a guest I answered worthy to be here, if you took it in isolation, would mean exactly the opposite of what he actually means.
All right. Yeah, that's why you have to see it in terms of a movement in the dialogue. In fact, Mr. Schwain used a beautiful term last evening in his meditation on the Hopkins poem. He said, somehow or other, when we read a poem, what do we always need to look for? Because there is a kind of internal drama in the poem. He used a peculiar kind of expression, and an important one. And it's probably one of the most helpful ways, no matter who we are, in reading any poem, because it's going to have a tremendous dramatic structure. He called it a fulcrum point. Remember that? He spoke of the fulcrum point, the turning point in the sonnet that he was talking about. And what we're asking, of course, is in this little three stanza, it's not probably accidental that it's Trinitarian, where a set of poems, verses, where is the fulcrum point, the turning point? And we see how we're building toward it. Love said, you shall be he. I, the unkind, ungrateful, notice the negatives before it. Ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand, and notice now the touch that moves across the speaking. It's a very careful progression in the poem, even though we're having a dramatic conflict. The Lord first speaks, and the Lord touches. Love took my hand, and smiling did reply. Who made the eyes but I? All monosyllables. Again.
That's really the first point at which you start to equate love with the Lord. I mean,
yes.
You know, just going from top to bottom.
Yes, yeah, it certainly is. What's his response? You would think, at this point, he would let go. That is, that the guest would let go of the argumentation. But as most of us know, and as I think we've heard over and over again, what is it that we love not to let go of? Our particular ego projects. Even if it's in the most intimate, sacred relationship, we simply want to hang on to whatever claim we could possibly make. And here, the argument keeps going on and on. You would think that by this time, if you were a sensitive man, you'd let go. He doesn't. Truth, Lord. And he's arguing, as I suppose anyone would do. Now, it's not like Job in violence, but it's still delicate and relentless. But I have marred him. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. Now he brings us to the, I suppose, one thing I have not reflected on in this poem very carefully at all, is the notion of shame. Why should he introduce it this time? Too forward, but I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. What is shame? I know Bill Bonhoeffer has pondered this a little bit, and I know any Old Testament scholar certainly is gets caught up in the story of the fall, because that's where the sense, he talks about guilt, and he talks about shame.
You know, normally we think of shame as being the public awareness of our guilt, but here he seems to be using it simply as a synonym for his knowledge that God is aware of his guilt. In other words, not public, but in this relationship.
Or maybe his humanity. Maybe it's just that he knows that he's a human being and doesn't really and truly deserve to be there with God.
I think so. There also seems to be a sharp distinction working through the poem between the mere notion of guilt, as we would talk about it, and one other notion, which is, of course, more specifically Christian and more disturbing, because he says in that second line that what is he guilty of? The dust of sin. And I guess I draw on the Kierkegaardian distinction. That is the distinction between guilt and sin. The idea of guilt and shame, suggesting the public horizontal problem that we all face when we've done something wrong. whereas sin has a kind of specificity about it, and relates the Christian to the person of God, or in this case, to the host himself.
How do you suppose this ties in with the fact that what they're talking about is the eyes, eyes?
My guess would be it is the notion that the eyes, if it seems to me, is it John, Epistles of John? The eyes are the source of sin. That's where lust, where all of the dirtiness enters in. They are the organs through which light comes and makes it possible for us to have our bearings in the world. And they are the organs which are extremely key for sin. That's why, what is the organ of faith? Not the eye. There's a Ayala altarpiece in Chicago, which I've always enjoyed seeing, because when the Holy Ghost, Annunciation, altarpiece, the altarpiece, and here is this, the Holy Spirit as a dove is above, and there is this beam of light going down to the Holy Spirit, and she conceives through the ear, the organ analepticum. This is the organ of faith, you know, that she should conceive through the ear, because the ear is the source, again, of that word which is spoken, and which evokes trust in the respondent. And so it seems to me that this is what we have going on here, this kind of distinction between the eye and the ear. The dialogue is the basic way in which this is carried on, because the basic thrust of the poem is about faith and relationship between host and guest, and now all monosyllables.
Aren't eyes also like, especially if the, you know, windows of the soul?
No, windows of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is also what he's doing. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, fine. With the dust there. Know you not, says love, who bore the blame? Because what has he said? Now here's where we get close to this vicarious and the question of justification. Here, right at the moment, the last moment, what will be his claim? Peculiar. He would like to stand in the place of the host. Truth, Lord, that I have marred them. Let my shame go where it doth deserve. And he's still focusing on his shame. And on, in a sense, even the worthiness of that shame which gets what it deserves. Which Luther would recognize, and Augustine, as the very, you know, I suppose what we'd say is the most vicious but beautiful insights of the Lutheran tradition, is how far what Augustine called amor sui, the love of self, will go. And here we see it carried to that final extent, highly aware of its own unworthiness, and arguing with the very guest who would overcome that spirituality that would make some kind of claim, even the claim that it makes here. Know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve. We would expect it by about this time. What would he do? Okay. No, sir. What does he want to do? He wants to be humble and serve the host. And what does the guest or the host say? You must sit down. It says, love and taste my meat. And then you have, as you have in many Herbert poems, finally the obedience of faith, as we would say. And this quick response again on monosyllables, so I did sit and eat. And the question is, of course, is that free, or is that given or come out of the relationship to the Lord as the speaker, the one who embodies love? Well, it's taken us more time to go through this, and we can't go to the Wallace Stevens poem, which in some ways, Wallace Stevens, unlike George Herbert, is very, very certain that the gods are dead. They've all gone over the hill. He was a classmate of T.S. Eliot's, or schoolmate, I should say, at Harvard, and was pretty certain that all of the he was attracted to the past, and you see in this poem he will use the story of Ulysses. And to be fair to him, his last poems, his later poems, suggest, and it's a sort of a beautiful thing to see, but you have to be, I suppose, careful how you respond to it. At the end, he has God sort of like a strange bird scratching with its beak on the window of the human soul. And he has a couple of longer poems which suggest, particularly in when he looks at the natural world that he knew up in New Hampshire, that whatever is present in this universe, he felt as he got older and older, there is something that to which the human resonates, which is always more than the human. But you will not find, except in probably one of the most important poems in the 20th century, a little thing called Sunday Morning, written by Wallace Stevens, in which he shows a young woman thinking about, you know, why am I not in church this morning? And he takes it's a very marvelously delicate and complex poem in which he shows many of what we would call the finest of the secular arguments for suggesting that Jesus is in the coffin where he lay. It's a denial of everything that the Christian faith stands for. The fact is that Wallace Stevens is a marvelously, marvelously able poet. And what I wanted to show is how he uses the idea of meditation and some of the most sympathetic treatments of this very secular poet have been done by Christian critics who are terribly interested in the role of meditation, because they see in Stevens probably some of the finest and most sensitive uses of the idioms of language coming out of basic experience of contemporary man, and are deeply moved by his work. I regret that because I've talked so much on the Herbert poem that we do not have the time to go through this. I believe we stop at 5:10, don't we?
You did it on purpose, of course, didn't you? Because as you say, your students always complain that you turn the poem to ashes. Well, you've given us three poems and two of them are not ashes.
Thanks a lot.
Why don't you read the Stevens poem?
You'll be allowed to. All right. It's a very tender poem because it's so human. Now don't forget, he assumes that there is no God out there and there is no haven. You know, there is no cheap immortality for Stevens. All there are human beings in a strange world, but it's a beautiful world. It's a world of nature, and for him, nature is a savage, impersonal, brilliant, moving reality. And the strange thing is, what does the human mind have to do? It's got to shape. It's got to shape that reality somehow or other so it's accommodated to our human experience. And so he takes an ancient story. And you remember, the story of Homer is essentially a story in which Homer chooses to die rather than to have the immortality of the gods. And his wife is at home waiting for him. What if you're simply two human beings and you know human love, and your husband has gone away and you love deeply, and here is Penelope waiting for her husband? Is it Ulysses that approaches from the east, the interminable adventurer? The trees are mended. That winter is washed away. Someone is moving on the horizon and lifting himself above it. A form of fire approaches the Cretons of Penelope, whose mere savage presence awakens the world in which she dwells. She has composed so long a self with which to welcome him, companion to his self or her, which she imagined, to in a deep-founded sheltering friend and dear friend. The trees had been mended as an essential exercise in an inhuman meditation larger than her own. No winds like dogs watched over her at night. She wanted nothing he could not bring her by coming alone. She wanted no fetchings. His arms would be her necklace and her belt, the final fortune of their desire. But was it Ulysses? Or was it only the warmth of the sun on her pillow? The thought kept beating in her like her heart. The two kept beating together. It was only day. It was Ulysses, and it was not. Yet they had met friend and dear friend, and the planet's encouragement. The barbarous strength within her would never fail. She would talk a little to herself as she combed her hair, repeating his name with its patient syllables, never forgetting him that kept coming constantly so near. I wish we could spend some time with the poem, but we can't.
Can you explain a little bit about the choice of these two to go to coordinate?
The idea is, along with the Christian and the arts, is to suggest, of course, I wish our art is dead friend. We're here. Maybe, I don't know. Remember the man who said this the other day? We need to bring into a circle of discussion people who I think would see that a man like Stevens, he's not our friend in the sense that he is evangelically out harboring Christians into the Christian church, but he's not our enemy either. He's a man whose poetry we can conspire with. we can work with his words and his language and his imagery and his grasp of the real. As Mr. Bonhoeffer said, sometimes God is more praised with the curses of the ungodly than with the sick hallelujahs of the pious. And if you've ever sat in sick Christian worship on a Sunday morning, and when you've heard these people, you're like, God, is God dead? Maybe dead in the worship. But here comes a pagan like Khrushchev, beating his shoe in the United Nations, crude and rude, but vital and alive. Or Andrew Young, causing a lot of discomfort everywhere. There's something about that kind of vigor, and when it's married to the kind of, the thing about Stevens is he is a snob. He's just the worst kind of snob. He was vice president of Hartford Insurance Company, successful businessman at the same time that he's a poet. His wife, I always introduce her to class, or my classes to it, by saying, you do know Wallace Stevens in ways which you'd never think. His wife, Holly, was the model for the Liberty Dime head, which everyone has seen and rubbed. It's an interesting thing. He comes from a distinguished family, married into a distinguished family, and of course he uses French words a great deal, and he uses especially French words and French quotes, and he turns off people rapidly, precisely because he is such a snob. But gosh, I found in the few years I've been around that whether they're slobs or snobs, they're all very strong egos. It's a question, where is it going to come?
Why did you pick this poem?
I picked this poem because it is essentially a meditative poem. Now, what I haven't had a chance to do is to elaborate on the way in which it's meditative. What he's saying, the key line, it seems to me, is line 21. The barbarous strength within her would never fail. What is the barbarous strength within her that will never fail? And here's where the link comes. It's a theological link or even a thematic link.
Well, it seems to be the yearning for
Hope. Her yearning, hope, And what is the form of yearning and hope in words? Well, I should say, what lies behind words? Imagination, human imagination, which keeps leaping out and creating and constructing and organizing the particular world and bringing about a unity. The unity that is structured here is the unity of the poem itself and the woman meditating and the strength of imagination to put together what Stevens has our meditative voice putting together here in the same way that the Herbert poem does it. Now, there are a lot of contemporary intellectuals who will get as much satisfaction out of meditating on that Stevens poem and, in a sense, making a god of the human imagination and seeing what it does in putting together unity and creating a possibility as, say, we would see in the Herbert poem.
It brings up the whole question of reality and what in the meditation. Her meditation becomes as real as the event.
Yes, exactly.
It's the old Shakespearean theme.
Yes.
Appearance of reality and all of that.
Behind it was another question and reason. Let me quote one note card. May I be permitted as professor to at least give you one academic reference? I was thinking primarily the work of David Bailey Harnett in Theology and the Arts. He's the University of Virginia, but out of Yale there. He says, the Greek word for truth is aletheia, which means that which is concealed, that which is veiled. So it is with the nature of, no, pardon me, it's a negative word. Aletheia, it's to unveil, to disclose, to tear away what is covered. He says that something is disclosed or unveiled. So it is with the nature of our world, which is unveiled and organized for us through the symbolic process that eventually leads to the arts. Because we cannot understand their import or connectedness until we grasp the whatness of things, the artist's venture is invested with vital significance. But this value, what truth the art is working toward, is derived from the character of aesthesis, that is, aesthetics, which is a horrible word and has been vitiated and needs to be crucified in many ways. But what he means by it is what I think we can understand by it, a disinterested perception. Not uninterested, but disinterested perception. A mode of consciousness concerned with nothing except particularity for its own sake. So that what absorbs the mind in the meditation of the Stevens poem is merely the absorption in the poem for its own sake. In its discreteness, in its images, in its arrangement of the world, in its organization of reality. We enter into that momentarily as we struggle in the dialogue that we have. And you'll notice that her dialogue, like the dialogue in the other poem, is an internal dialogue. Depends on answer, question, response, probing, grasping, reaching for what is the true and the real. And so, you know, for a Harnett and for most of us, there is a divine kind of inutility to the arts in which they are separated from action, from purpose, from real life. And they're important for their own sake. Now, I think our objections to the artist is that we have a cult of aesthetes in the modern world who become, I think, parasites. And the beautiful thing about, I think, the Christian faith is it keeps calling us back to the everyday. You know, what do we do in the human community once we looked at the discreteness of the grasp that Stevens has given us? And that's where we come back, I think, to our Christian faith.